very handsome introduction. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming. I feel that for good or ill, for better or worse, one could say that I speak for myself, have already spoken for myself throughout that documentary. I don't propose to stand between you and the chance to raise any questions that you may have, comrades. I thought it might not be unhelpful, note the use of the not un, if I just updated slightly and said how I came from the film to my little book, The Missionary Position. I first owe also a debt to a group I never expected to incur a debt from, namely the Hell's Angels organization, which I now gather is a limited and incorporated trade name company. First drew that to my attention when they lobbied Channel 4 against the title of that film. And we're here tonight with documentary proof of their copyright claim. I feel I should say that I was very much opposed to that title. I thought it was cheap. I thought it was nasty. I thought it was offensive. I thought it was insensitive. I wanted to call the film Sacred Cow. which would have been, I thought, more apt in that it bears on fundamentalist religion in India and the tendency of human beings to make icons out of flesh. But they wouldn't wear that for some reason that no one has yet been willing to explain to me. My motives, people ask, well, apart from the ones that have already been pointed out, to make money and to make myself famous at whatever cost. I know most journalists are expected to be in business to be poor and unknown. I guess I can't. This is America. I didn't cross the Atlantic to pursue that line of career. My motive really was threefold. Well, it began as two. First was to examine what really had already taken on by then the lineaments of a myth. A person promoted by my profession, let it be said, almost to the standards of someone above human comprehension. I thought that the most elementary curiosity mandated a second look in that direction, and I was guided in this by the precept offered by George Orwell in his famous essay on Mahatma Gandhi, the first line of which is, "Saints should always be presumed guilty until they can be proved innocent." A precept, in my view, of skepticism and free inquiry and honest doubt, without which science and culture and medicine and free expression would be impossible, and without which, incidentally, the relief of poverty would be a non-subject. Second, I wanted to beef up the secular forces, such as they are, in modern society, against what I have thought of for a long time as the clear and present threat of fundamentalist and fanatical teaching and the spread of these ideas among established monotheist religions. What I am now calling, as the second millennium approaches, the numinous date of the year 2000, or if you prefer, 2001, PMS, premillennial syndrome, the pangs and anxieties that are spreading through the cortex of our culture, leading to certain kinds of secular and sacred and profane unease. I thought that we should be on our guard against fundamentalism, in particular when it comes cloaked in the guise of sincerity, charity, disinterest, and compassion, as fundamentalism so often in these days does. This is the excuse made, for example, by Ayatollah Khomeini. It is the excuse made by the Hamas organization that it looks after the poor, that it provides welfare, that it is of the people. All people who make excuses like that deserve to have their claims examined in public and not repeated to you uncritically by an echo chamber, megaphone, mass media. Now I have a third motive, the third motive that's occurred to me more since the book came out and in view of recent events in public, the turning of large parts of central London into a wailing wall, and the decision by the mass media to refer to all those who were present at that rather otiose and sentimental event as us, as we, not to cover those who mourned, but to say that we were all there, that it was our mourning that was being reported back to us, to conscript everybody into the world of the vicarious and the virtual and the celebrity culture. Mother Teresa and Princess Diana had a symbiotic relationship in evolving this world of the uncriticized and uncritical celebrity. And I chose the word vicarious with some care. Those who want to live their lives through others, who want to lead a virtual life and not, as it were, get a life of their own, those who want to have someone else go and do everything for them are, of course, inclined to pick upon icons to say, well, I'm not going to go to the third world. I'm not even going to educate myself about it, let alone go and work there. I'm just very glad someone is doing it for me and on my behalf. Of course, the reaction of a person who has invested that amount of their personality in an unexamined virtual or vicarious figure will resist the idea that they may have been taken for a ride and may have, in fact, invested their hopes in a fraud. Well, I understand that feeling, and though I don't respect it, but I don't feel that I'm obliged to do anything other than offer it a fair and honest and open challenge. I think also that the importing into our language surreptitiously of the words icon and idol so recently, so uncritically, is something that is flat out and downright sinister. Icon means idol. It means graven image. It means what it says. That's why some of us are not afraid to be called iconoclasts or the breakers of images. Honest religion has always warned against the worship of graven images, against the making of idols, especially and most potently against the worship of mediocre, ordinary, sinful human beings. Well, where are our cultural defenses now against this kind of idolatry and superstition? And what are our church leaders doing that they encourage the spread of this sort of paganism? I think it's a question that deserves to be put, and I think it's a disgrace that it takes a scrofulous atheist like myself to be the first one to propose it. Shame on you. Shame on those of you who take your faith seriously. I also wanted to say a word in defense of the city of Calcutta. The city of Calcutta, as you can glimpse in that film, but only glimpse, and you must go for yourself and see, is one of the most pleasant surprises in the modern world. It's a beautiful city. It's a city of great culture. It's full of universities, of bookshops, of cafes, of film schools, of discussion, of a wonderful and very various free press, which, for instance, on Mother Teresa's death, wonderful English language press in Bengal as well, published a tremendous editorial saying, Calcutta owed her nothing when she died, said the Calcutta Telegraph. She owed Calcutta everything. It was from the misery of our city that she carved the stepping stones of her great career. Look in vain in your press, ladies and gentlemen, not just for a statement as plain as that, but for a report that that was indeed the view of the Calcutta press. I don't think you would find it. The story is the story. Once written, my profession is not going to re-examine itself. Pity about that, that one should have to be a media critic as well as a journalist, but there it is. Someone has to do it. Calcutta is not a place of the abject. It is a foul lie to say that without Lady Bountiful, these people would not be able to brush the flies from their eyes, would only be able to extend a stick-like hand in abject gratitude. Bengalis do not beg. That is why those who wish to use the poor as a raw material, as a human resource for their demonstrations, must pick on those who are defenseless, who they can find dying or abandoned in the street, and who can be dragged in to that filthy room where the bright little sign on the wall says, I'm going to heaven today. Can you imagine more of an insult than that? Mother Teresa has been given millions and millions and millions of dollars in public by great figures and institutions, as I showed you, since that hospice opened, and it still hasn't been swept out. What does she do with the money? Well, there's no audit possible. They don't keep the money in India because the Indian government demands an audit. Where's the money gone? To those, the sincere people, perhaps some of them in this room, who sent their money for the relief of poverty and suffering and disease, they might want to inquire, where did it go? We have ocular demonstration and proof that it was not spent in Calcutta on the poor. Could it be that Mother Teresa was telling the truth, as she did on the screen just now, by saying, well, she has got round to opening 500 convents. What is preached in these houses of religion and worship, which are an order devoted to the worship of a single individual, this order is certainly soon going to be renamed. It won't be the Missionaries of Charity. It will be the Sisters of Mother Teresa. You can count on it. A cult. What is preached in these houses of worship? What is preached is what you heard her preach. That the poor women of the world must sacrifice control over their fertility to the church and to their husbands. That they may not be raised to a floor where they can decide how often they get pregnant. Everybody knows who cares to know that the floor of poverty can be raised in 1 year by the education of women. Give women education, give them control over their fertility, give them a little capital, teach them to read, instantly infant mortality goes down. Instantly dirt and disease and illiteracy and poverty can be combated. Come back in only a year. In Zimbabwe or Bolivia, it doesn't matter where you try it, it always works. Who worked all her life against that interpretation of poverty but Mother Teresa? Who said God will always provide? Who said a woman cannot have too many children? Who said that a woman who attempts to limit her infertility is committing murder? Who disgraced her entire gender and insulted our intelligence by saying that that is the greatest threat to world peace? That is the greatest threat to world peace. This is fanaticism writ large, and I cannot accuse it of hypocrisy. There were hypocritical things in Mother Teresa's life. No question, no error. But most of the time she told the truth. She was completely sincere, she was completely fanatical, completely bigoted, completely dogmatic, completely fundamentalist. Forgiveness. Forgiveness. I'll just make one or two random points and close myself down. Many people told me that it was wrong for me to mock her for saying forgive in Bhopal. After all, it was funny how her damage control instincts were so finely tuned that as soon as a multinational was in trouble and immense forces of protest were moving in Bhopal against the outrageous treatment of the people of the city by Union Carbide, immediately she flew in, no one asked her to, and said, we must learn to forgive Union Carbide. It's an interesting first reaction. It seemed to me to have all the things I'd learned from her other political stands. Always intervene when you see the status quo being challenged. Preempt. But people said, come on, what's forgiveness isn't so bad. She even offered me forgiveness, though I hadn't asked for it either. Well, then the question is, and didn't actually give her or grant her the right to bestow it, if it comes to that. Hadn't sought it. Then comes the question, okay, if some Christians are right, and if Ophelia is right, that the quality of mercy is not strained, and is one of the most beautiful things. Did I say Ophelia? I mean Portia. Excuse me. If Portia is right, and this is true, then how general is this forgiveness going to be? Would you, I'll take a question at random, would you, Mother Teresa, forgive a woman in Ireland who had found herself married to a drunken, wife-beating, child abuser and alcoholic, unemployable, who wished to divorce him and remarry? Would you forgive her for making that? No. Would you ever forgive her? No. Would you threaten her with condemnation in the next world as well as this one? Yes. Would you threaten to deny her the sacraments? Yes. The answer to all those questions is yes. She went to Ireland when these matters were put to a referendum 2 years ago. Ireland was then the only country in Europe to have a constitutional ban on divorce and remarriage. Every political party in the Republic had called for this ban to be lifted. Mother Teresa intervened very decisively on the no side at a very important stage. No forgiveness for those who challenge canon law and challenge the right of the Church to make law for the whole of Ireland and all people living in it, which, by the way, is a far greater threat to peace in an island that has at least two kinds of Christianity on it than anything I can readily imagine. Well, so we're not forgiving all the time, are we? Next, the week after that referendum campaign, she gave an interview in the United States, the Ladies' Home Journal. I have the interview. Anyone can see it. I can show it to you. They don't ask her about the Irish referendum, but they do ask her about her new friend, Princess Diana. How's that going? How's your friendship with the princess? We notice you're always being seen around with her. The questions are very tough questions in the Ladies' Home Journal. Mother Teresa says, well, you know, she's fine. She's doing really well. She's much better since that divorce, which is a great thing for her, says Mother Teresa, because it was really an unhappy marriage of everyone. Well, now, there used to be a word for this. It was before the Enlightenment. Anyway, it was the sale of indulgences. The Church was notorious for it. It would sell pardons to the rich, and while preaching hellfire and damnation and discipline to the poor. In what way? I invite replies. In what way is the precept and character and conduct of Mother Teresa remotely different from that forgotten, dismal medieval practice? I submit in no way at all. I submit it's the same ethic, the same theology, the same aesthetic, the same fundamentalism. I will just, if I may, there's one thing that I didn't have when I did the film, which is the letter that was written by the court in Los Angeles to Mother Teresa in the matter of Charles Keating. Mother Teresa, I have her letter. It's in my book, which I hope you'll all get to swell my foul revenues. I've reprinted the letter that Mother Teresa wrote to the court saying, leave Mr. Keating alone. He is, I quote, a great friend of the poor, wholehearted and free service, etc., etc. She got a reply, which was sent to me by the deputy district attorney in Los Angeles, a man named Mr. Paul Turley. I've never met Mr. Turley. He wrote to me quite out of the blue as a citizen. I would judge from his writing, I'll leave it to you to decide, I would judge that if he isn't himself a practicing Catholic, he certainly has had at one stage of his life a very good and rigorous Catholic education. Bear with me while I share it with you. Don't you love the word share? Dear Mother Teresa, he wrote back. Remember, she initiated this correspondence and said Keating was a friend of the poor. I am a deputy district attorney in Los Angeles County and one of the persons who worked on the prosecution of your benefactor, Charles H. Keating. I read your letter to Judge Ito. It was Judge Ito, by the way, rather wonderfully. Written on behalf of Mr. Keating, which includes your admission. I'm not trying to shout him down, I promise. There is a way in which you can't have too many of them. You can have too much of them, though. I read your letter to Judge Ito, written on behalf of Mr. Keating, which includes your admission that you know nothing about Mr. Keating's business or the criminal charges presented to Judge Ito. I am writing to you to provide a brief explanation of the crimes of which Mr. Keating has been convicted, to give you an understanding of the source of the money that Mr. Keating gave to you, and to suggest that you perform the moral and ethical act of returning the money to its rightful owners. Mr. Keating was convicted of defrauding 17 individuals of more than $900,000. These 17 persons were representative of 17,000 individuals, from whom Mr. Keating stole $252 million, believed to be the largest heist in American financial history still, by the way. Mr. Keating's specific acts of fraud were that he was the source of a series of fraudulent representations made to persons who bought bonds from his company, and also was the repository of crucial information which he chose to withhold from bond purchasers, thereby luring his victims into believing they were making a safe, low-risk investment. In truth and in fact, their money was being used to fund Mr. Keating's exorbitant, extravagant lifestyle. The victims of Mr. Keating's fraud came from a wide spectrum of society. Some were wealthy and well-educated. Most were people of modest means and unfamiliar with high finance. One was indeed, here I think Turley lays it on a bit thick, a poor carpenter. He may have felt he had to do that. If I could have found a carpenter, I'd probably have put him in too. One was indeed a poor carpenter who did not speak English well, Aramaic, and had his life savings stolen by Mr. Keating's fraud. The biblical slogan, goes on the deputy district attorney, of your organization is, as long as you did it to one of these my least brethren, you did it to me. The least of the brethren among those whom Mr. Keating fleeced without flinching. As you well know, divine forgiveness is available to all. But forgiveness must be preceded by admission of sin. Not only has Mr. Keating failed to admit his sins and his crimes, he persists in self-righteously blaming others for his own misdeeds. Your experience is with the poor. My experience has been with the con man and the perpetrator of fraud. It is not uncommon for con men to be generous with family, friends, and charities. Perhaps they believe that their generosity will purchase love, respect, or forgiveness. Incidentally, if they believe that, they appear, judging by the reaction of credulous public opinion, to be absolutely right. But I pass over that too. However, the time when the purchase of indulgences was an acceptable method of seeking forgiveness died with the Reformation, we wish. No church, no charity, no organization should allow itself to be used as a salve for the conscience of the criminal. We all are grateful that forgiveness is available, but we all also must perform our duty. That includes the judge and the jury. I remind myself of the biblical admonition of the prophet Micah. O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you? To do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly. We are urged to love mercy, but we must do justice. You urge Judge Ito to look into his heart as he sentences Keating and to do what Jesus would do. I submit the same challenge to you. Ask yourself what Jesus would do if he were given the fruits of a crime. What he would do if he were in possession of money that had been stolen. What Jesus would do if he were being exploited by a thief to ease his conscience. I submit that he would promptly and unhesitatingly return the stolen property to its rightful owners. You should do the same. You have been given money by Mr. Keating that he has been convicted of stealing by fraud. Do not permit him the indulgences he desires. Do not keep the money. Return it to those who worked for it and earned it. If you contact me, I will put you in direct contact with the rightful owners of the property, now in your possession. This is a correspondence very easy to summarize, ladies and gentlemen. It was opened by Mother Teresa's letter. It closes with this one. She never wrote back. She never acknowledged. She acknowledged receipt, but that's the last we hear of it. We are dealing here with nothing supernatural, nothing saintly, with just another human being, someone who believed that we are all of us, conceived hopelessly in sin and vileness and iniquity, and who I think should, in justice and in fairness, have included herself in that very capacious, however questionable, definition. Thank you.